trying to think of all the Nancys I know.
Well, you know me, and I'm a Nancy.
I used to say I was the only Nancy in San Francisco, but then I thought again.
Another family.
It's pretty much a Trek household, actually.
Ah.
Trek and Bevo. Nice.
Love flies out the door when money comes in your window.
In your window.
Oh,
that is bad.
Come on, it's darling. Drama, darlings, it's drama.
It's drama. It's massive lesbianism.
Hell yeah.
You're listening to the Happiness Patrol.
Last week over in New York City, yes, New York City, two of our intrepid Happiness Patrol reporters were there to get this amazing interview with Winston Churchill himself, a.k.a. Mr. Ian McNeice.
This is Andre T.
This is Michelle H.
And we are recording this in Cafe 50 at a Evening with Ian McNeice. And that is a Who York event. And Mr. McNeice, welcome to the Happiness Patrol.
Welcome to the Happiness Patrol.
Oh, welcome to the Happiness Patrol. And how exciting to be here in New York City.
Excellent. Have you gotten a chance to see much of the city?
Absolutely not. The only place I've been is to the Comic-Con.
Oh.
I'm back to bed again. And that's it. So, no, I ain't seen anything of New York. I'm very excited to have done such a big event.
There were a lot of people who were very excited to see you.
No, I'm always amazed that it really does fill me with absolute joy because a lot of people come up and they're very enthusiastic. They've seen a lot of my work, which is great over the years, and it really is. It's I can only liken it to drowning. Your whole life just comes before you in one go, as they mention things you've done over the years. Yeah.
Another thing that I noticed, that people were walking past you, and they would walk past the Doctor Who store booth that you were sitting at, and they would go, "Oh my God, it's Winston Churchill!" And they're very excited to see you. I know that you've played Winston Churchill a number of times, and in fact, you have a new role in playing Winston Churchill coming up. Before you got that first role in the play playing Winston Churchill, were you a big fan of the man, or was it just?
I actually knew very little of him because that was one of the. That's always one of the good things about working on a show like that is that, especially when you're trying to recreate a historical figure who was for real, and so it's like it does mean that you go out and you research the character thoroughly, you learn about the period, you learn about him, and you've got a terrific responsibility because you're trying to portray a character. Now, what you try and do with it, you don't make it a caricature of the individual. I obviously read a lot of books. I actually saw a lot of movies that people had done and TV shows where they portrayed him. And what I tried to do is to try to get the essence of the man rather than trying to do a caricature. So you get the humor of the man, the intelligence of the man, the energy of the man. He was obviously very, very bright and actually very, very funny too. A lot of the things that he comes out with are hysterically funny. There was this woman who said to him at some function or other, she said, "Good God, Mr. Churchill, are you drunk?" And he said, "You know, madam, the difference between us is that when I wake up in the morning, I will be sober, but you will still be ugly."
As you prepared for the role, was there anything special that you did to do that, sir?
Well, I did. I went to Blenheim Palace, and I saw where he was born and grew up a little bit, and then I went to his graveyard, and I was standing over his graveyard. It was like a November day. It was very, very dusky, and there was a little mist over the graveyard, little owl up in a tree somewhere, and suddenly I could hear this whisper coming up from the ground saying, "Don't fuck it up, boy." I didn't know whether I'm allowed to swear on your program, and for those people who listen and did hear that word, or maybe it got bleeped out, I don't know. I apologize.
Nothing to worry about. We earn our fucking explicit tag.
We know all the bad words.
I'm glad of that. No, I'm glad. bad at that.
Another thing that that you mentioned when you were talking to the New York crowd was the portal, as it were. You likened it to drowning, that opens up when you do Doctor Who, and you get to go to all sorts of different conventions and different places. What are some of your favorite experiences with fans since working on Doctor Who?
Well, I have to say that I've now done so many conventions. I've done several of them in Britain themselves, in little places, some big, some small, and then of course the ones abroad. I've done the Chicago TARDIS, the Chicago Comic Con, now this huge one in New York, and the one in Los Angeles. But I think the one in Los Angeles has got to be the mother of all shows, hasn't it, really? Because it is such a friendly family event in a way. I mean, because everybody loves Doctor Who, and I got very excited because I passed this table and I suddenly had this gentleman saying, "Do you fancy a cruise?" And I went, "I'm sorry." He said, "Well, we do these sci-fi cruises." I said, "You mean I could go on a cruise?" He said, "Yes, you could go on a cruise." And I said, "What would I have to do?" He said, "All you have to do is sit and have dinner with various people and then maybe give a talk or two." And I said, "Where do you go? Do you go around the Caribbean?" He said, "Yeah, we've been around the Caribbean, but this one's going to the Arctic." I said, "Maybe I'll wait for the one that's going around the Caribbean and get back to me on that one, okay?"
Oh, I don't blame you one bit, and I can tell you, and I think I speak for Michelle as well here, at Gallifrey, we really enjoyed having you there, and for lack of a better term, it seemed like during LobbyCon, you definitely were holding court, and everybody was enthralled and hanging on every single word, much like we are now with you.
No, LobbyCon, and I don't think it's like any other place where you're in a hotel lobby, where the high tables, and at every table there was alcohol brought in by your good selves, and the hotel just turned a blind eye to it, mainly because I believe that the bar makes more money in that weekend than they do in an awfully long time themselves, so it's not for want of a better thing. But the atmosphere is such a good atmosphere, and such a welcoming atmosphere, and the fun that everybody has, the whole event and the Q&As are very good, and also the commentaries that we have to do with the shows too. Very well organized, very well put together, great bunch of people, and as I said before, that wonderful opening from Peter Davidson, which will stay with me for many, many years, and as a tribute to the people that turn up for him to want to do that for you as well, knowing how well it would go down, and it went down terrifically well too, so no, all praise to him for that.
Actually, that movie that you saw was a sequel. When he was unable to make the con the year before, he sent a movie over that he made of why he missed his flight and wasn't able to come to the show. So it was when the movie started, everybody was a little bit tense because we thought perhaps he wasn't going to show up again. But we would have had you. So
I didn't realize that, and that actually makes it even doubly more interesting than the one before. And so everybody must have been on tenterhooks thinking, "Oh no, he's blanked it again." But that wonderful moment when he came through the police box, the TARDIS, and came out to such a rapturous, warm applause. No, fantastic. Fantastic.
We stopped by several times up on the convention floor, and it really is a testament. This was not a Doctor Who convention, but I stood there for an hour to see if we could interview you, and you didn't have a moment's respite at all. And just quite frankly, you know, you're an animal, sir.
An animal is true, I know. I have to say, it did really get to me after a while that we've been going for such a long time. It was like, I think we started like, I don't know, 10 or 11 or something, and it went on for hours before I don't think we even got a break today. I think we went all the way through, but it's a testament to how popular member, even in something like Comic-Con, which is really not about Doctor Who, it's about so much more else, but people find you. I'm doing a film at the moment, a little independent movie in Britain with David Tennant. I'm playing his father in a show called Nativity, and in the rehearsals for the film was just before the weekend in Earl's Court in London, where David Tennant signed for the first time. And he'd seen the website and he went to me, "Oh, I see you're on the website, I see you're going to this convention at Earl's Court." He said, "This is the first time." I said, "This is your first time? You've never done one of these before?" I said, "Your feet are not going to touch the ground." I said, "You've got no idea what's going to happen to you." And on the day, I saw him at the end of the day and he looked absolutely drained. And I said to him, "Well, how was it?" And he said, "It was amazing." He said, "I must have done over 900 autographs," he said, "and 500 pictures, photographs he took." And he said, "But it's amazing. And I meet such nice people and such interesting people." And, and that was the first one he'd ever done. So long may it continue. I think David Tennant will probably be a fan of conventions just like myself.
And speaking of fans, Doctor Who's been on the air for a very, very long time. And I was wondering, how much of it did you watch, you know, before you were on it? Did you watch the classic series? Do you watch the new series? What are your Doctor Who memories?
Like everybody in the past, I was aware of it growing up, and you dabble, you know, as you go along. And I do remember various shows along the way, watching them, and I think I must have seen at various intervals all of the Doctors at some point, I would think, over the years, because they all linger in my mind from time to time. But no one in particular. I suppose I'm asked the question, which is your favorite Doctor? And it's a tough one, that. I would say the one I'm working with at the moment, Matt. I think it's got to be the praise. But I suppose I'd also have a special place for the other Doctor I worked with recently, which is Tom Baker, too, because he's such an eccentric individual.
Well, that's to say the least. And Mr. McNeese, we definitely thank you for your time, and we also thank Doctor Who Store for bringing you to New York Comic Con, and by doing that, making this available. We definitely hope that you come back to more cons. We definitely hope that you come back to the show again, and thank you for your time.
On behalf of all of the fans, not just me and Andre and the people who are here at Who York tonight, but everybody who came by the booth and got to see you and was so happy, you made so many people happy today. And let it never be said that Ian McNeese can't go for hours, because you certainly did. And thank you so much for your patience and your dedication, sir.
No problem. Well, no, it's been a delight. And I have to say, it never ceases to amaze me, that moment when somebody turns the corner and they look at me and they just giggle and they go, "Oh my God, it's you." And I go, "Yes, it's me." And they go, "It's you." And that never ceases to amaze me and give me joy.
So I got an email the other day at the Gmail account.
Did you?
Yes.
What did it say?
Yeah, well, it's actually from a nice, lovely lady named Daisy Duke? Kaufman.
Oh, not Daisy Duke.
No, not Daisy Duke. But
you can introduce me to Beau, because.
But her and her recording partner have a new podcast, another new Doctor Who podcast coming out.
A new Doctor Who podcast.
Yes.
That's just what the world needs.
It's called The Sonic Toolbox, and I want to wish them luck. We've actually Skyped a little bit. They've got two episodes out, and they talk a lot about...
Who's the recording partner, dear?
Oh, Cheryl. Daisy and Cheryl. There we go.
So, Daisy and Cheryl.
Yeah. So they got something called the Sonic Toolbox. So go listen to them. Tell them that the Happiness Patrol sent you. And they talk about alien technology and Doctor Who fantasy technology. But they also talk about real technology, too. So it's for all you techno geeks out there, I think you might like it. So go check it out. It's the Sonic Toolbox. So she says... on a side note, she goes, I've been listening to the Happiness Patrol since about episode 10. You get me laughing out loud when I listen, which makes my coworkers look funny at me. And I was so happy to hear Dale back recently, and I'm so sad not to hear Tara. Oh, we are too, Daisy. We are too. You guys are a large part of what has inspired me to start my own Doctor Who podcast.
Really? I'm so sorry.
So anyway,
Daisy and Cheryl, the best of luck to you.
Yes. So
cool.
So that's good.
But, in other podcaster news.
Inspiring people. How lovely is that? We're inspiring people to become mad bastards.
Yay. So what were you going to say, Nancy?
In other podcaster news, I went to Terry Lightfoot's birthday party last weekend.
Miss Lightfoot.
Was that cake?
Miss Lightfoot, yes. There was cake. Yes.
Was
a TARDIS cake, and there was paella. And
was it jelly?
And there was too much sangria.
Was there jelly?
And there was Doctor Who.
No, was there jelly?
Was there jelly?
Yeah.
No.
Well, that's rubbish.
But there was sangria. Sangria and paella.
And here's the big one.
Uh-oh.
I convinced Terry to come to Galley next year.
Good for you.
Congratulations. You've convinced another person to become bankrupt.
Well, she's not much farther away from L.A. than I am, so it's a cheap trip.
So maybe you guys can ride together. That'd be great.
Maybe.
Yeah, you never know.
I don't know.
The back of Terry's moped.
Because she's a hippie, man.
But even so, I mean, it's a cheap flight, so it's not so bad. But, so she's going to come because, you know, I didn't realize this. She is a big Paul McGann fan, and, you know, it's just, like, going to be McGann Fest at Galley this year.
Is it going to be McGannerific?
It's going to be McGannerific. So, yeah, she needs to come.
Oh dear,
but yes,
God,
yes. And her dear podcasting partner Ulan Sputnik was there. He came all the way from the party. It's lovely.
Ulan Sputnik, he's a Brit.
Yeah.
With that name, I wouldn't doubt it. For God's sake, that'd be like calling yourself Dale. Oh, never mind.
Yeah, well, there you have it. So I want to congratulate Dale and the Oodcast for coming back. They've been on a break, and the Oodcast is back. And I just listened to them all the way through this time. Hello. Oh, how about that?
And listen to another podcast.
I listen to another podcast, and for people who know me, they'll be very surprised. Wetting their britches with surprise, I might say. So yeah.
What the frickin' hell was that meant to be?
Just don't.
I'm not even going there. So yeah, the Oodcast was on vacation, but now they're back and they're sounding great. Great. So yeah. Go check them out.
Where did Ood go on holiday?
I don't know where.
I don't know. That's what I'm bloody asking.
Oh, I thought it was a riddle.
I want to know where Ood go on holiday.
Well, we'll have to ask him. Find out. Ask Laura. Next time we see her, ask her. So, yay. Happy birthday, Terry. Happy birthday, Terry Lightfoot.
Happy birthday, Terry.
There's a few cows and personalities in the Doctor Who podcasting world, and Terry Lightfoot is definitely one of them. The personalities, that is, not the cows.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay. I like cows. Cows are cool.
We just saw the last episodes of the Sarah Jane Adventures, and it was a bittersweet goodbye to Miss Liz Sladen. Quite honestly, I liked them. I liked the last three episodes, or the last three stories in the last six episodes. I enjoyed them immensely. I think I probably enjoyed them a little bit more, kind of knowing that, you know, these were the last ones I was going to be able to see, you know, or the last ones in a long line. And I just wanted to see, Dale, how you holding up?
Well, it upset me a lot. It really did. I mean, it was a great story to finish on. I have to say it was one of the better and funnier ones I've seen in a while. it was very hard to watch the last episode. And as soon as when episode 5 finished and episode 6 was next, there was this almost like sense of doom just waiting around the corner, thinking it's the last episode tomorrow. What are you going to do? Literally, it was hard. It was very hard to watch. And I have to say, the last minute or so, the little montage, uh-huh, and the redone or an alternate version of Liz's family monologue from series 1. That's what slaughtered me. I was a sobbing, snotty mess for hours afterwards.
See,
It's almost been a double whammy with this one, because Liz died in April,
right?
And it really, really shocked and affected people, including me. And yeah, but you get over that, you move on, you think, okay, yes, it's a sad loss, but now it's come home in a second wave, if you like, because we've now lost Sarah Jane, because there will be no more Sarah Jane. Mm-hmm. And it was like losing her all over again. It was very bizarre indeed. It was very bizarre actually thinking, hang on, you've already mourned Liz's loss. Uh-huh. But I think it mattered more to me that we won't see Sarah Jane again. So it was a very double-edged thing. I mean, it was a great final season, and it was going so well.
I really enjoyed the addition of the new little girl.
Sky.
Yes, Sky. I enjoyed her a lot. It looked like she was really going to catch on and be quite a little character. I would love to have seen her develop as far as the character, you know, and everything. So, and it was really cool to see the interaction between Sky and her big brother, you know.
Yeah, Luke and Sky were cool. I have to say, one of the saddest things about it is that we won't see any more of Clyde and Rani, because I think both of them are amazing. You know, great characters, amazing actors. Mm-hmm. And I really hope they turn up in Doctor Who. I so want them to, you know, even if it's just a cameo in the background.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, or maybe be an assistant for a Christmas special. How cool would that be?
That would be very nice. That would be very cool.
They were such, I mean, the actors are absolutely brilliant, so can't praise them highly enough.
Yeah, that would be good. That would be great. Ronnie, I just love. And you know, and Clyde actually really, really, you could see him improve acting-wise, you know, and character-wise. It was great. It was. I just like that character a lot now.
I think Daniel Anthony's always been very good.
Well, before, you know, originally,
but he's grown up a lot while he's in the role.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
you can see how he's grown up and how Clyde accordingly has grown up as you go along. Uh-huh. So I think it's a very nice touch.
He's a grown man, for crying out loud. He's good, and I think that whatever else comes on, you know, I'm sure the BBC is not going to turn a blind eye to these guys if they show up to audition for any kind of high profile or good good juicy bits.
We'll have to see.
That would be very cool. That would be very cool.
But they ended it very nicely. It was a very nice wrapping up.
Uh huh.
And the bingo, and the story goes on forever, was a very nice touch. You know, just to wrap it all up for the kids.
Yeah, that was nice.
But the montage slew me. Absolutely slew me.
I was, you know, I have to say I was a little, well, maybe I wasn't as emotionally tied into it as you were. But I was, I think maybe because of the buildup, I was expecting a bit more from the montage. It was nice. I wasn't expecting a montage. Oh, really?
I wasn't expecting a montage. I was expecting, you know, a sort of goodbye at the end, but to see the montage and everybody and the Doctor was in there and K-9 was in there, and I just thought, ow, this hurts.
Yeah,
but it's meant to hurt. It's good that it hurts. You know, it shows that we still care.
Yeah. Hey, does on a related note, do you have a whistle for K-9?
I do. I do have a whistle for K-9, and I also have a dog lead for K-9. And a trolley.
Last week on the Happiness Patrol, we were very happy to have David J. Howe and Sam Stone come visit us on the Happiness Patrol Halloween special, and I would be remiss not to include some of the stuff that I just felt like didn't quite fit on the Halloween special, simply because I figured you probably didn't want to listen to a Happiness Patrol that was 3 hours long, but we did have a few things that I wanted to include here. So here is David J. Howe and Sam Stone and Dale and the rest of the crew talking about Telos Publishing and the Vampire Gene Trilogy. Enjoy.
Being a writer,
yeah,
is all about sharing ideas. It's all about, you know, being able to put down in words ideas, concepts, themes, arguments, discussions, and have other people be able to follow them, understand them, agree with them or disagree with them, and to know why they are doing that. And I think that's the case whether you're writing a novel or a factual book or anything, yeah? If, as a writer, you are not able to put something down in writing that people can actually access, then you're kind of not doing part of the job that you set out to do. I would kind of append that with just the thought that, again, it depends on what sort of thing you're writing, because I'm very aware, obviously, that if I picked up some kind of physics textbook or something, I probably wouldn't have a clue, because it's written on the basis that you do actually, the reader does actually understand a certain element about what it is that you're talking about. So media studies books, for example, tend to be a little bit more impenetrable than sort of other books, etc. So you have to have an understanding of the market you're writing for. But certainly, if you're writing on television culture, or if you're writing a book that you're expecting anybody from, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 years up to 50, 100 years old to read, you've got to make it accessible to everybody. And again, one of the things that we tried to do with all of our books was to never talk down to the audience. So you never talk down to them. You never assume that, you know, that they don't know what you're talking about, kind of thing. But you always pitch it such that all the information they need is there. You know, you don't need to go anywhere else to be able to understand this book. And that's very important. And you do have to actually work at that. It's not something that, you know, would necessarily just happen.
So, David.
Absolutely.
Speaking of Doctor Who books and technical books for hardcore Doctor Who fans out there, I want to mention this one book. We had talked about it a little bit at Galley, and I was just like, whoa, I can't believe how he can do this. It's called Time Link. And it's basically a Doctor Who continuity guide.
Yes, it's one of the scariest things.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about this? Because I think we have some hardcore Doctor Who listeners, fans out there listening. Whoa,
one or
hello.
Two. Sam, she's just tripped over the gravestone. Are you okay, darling?
Sorry. Sorry down there. No offense, mate.
No, I think she's all right. She's back on her feet again. Yes, time link, because obviously there are one or two Doctor Who people listen to this. I mean, John Preddle is the author, and John is an incredible archivist and researcher, very diligent, very painstaking in getting all of the facts right. And Time Link, I don't know how it's like, you know, you watch every episode of Doctor Who, or you listen to them if they don't exist, because every episode exists either in visual or audio form. So you either watch them or you listen to them, and you look at the photographs, and every single piece of fact or continuity you write down. So what we're talking here about is, on the DVD, if there is a calendar on the wall behind them in the office, you freeze frame and see what month it is, what days ringed. If they walk past a car in the street, you freeze frame it and see what the tax disc says on the car that they walk past in the street. Absolutely everything that you actually see or hear on the television program, you write it down, and then you put all that together in a continuity guide to say, well, this was set at this time, at that time of day, it was dark, so there it must be that, and that calendar said then, so it must be that year, and they referenced, and you basically do the whole of Doctor Who, every single story, old and new series, in that way. And you basically come out with a book which kind of tells you in terms of facts, exactly when everything should have happened and in what order.
And then John basically he takes that and throughout the entire series and gives you like almost like a dateline, or
he does a timeline. He does a dateline of you know, from the beginning of time immemorial right the way through to the end of the world and beyond. You know, a timeline of this is where every single action in the Doctor Who universe might have happened, based solely on what you saw and heard in those television episodes.
Wow.
So it doesn't take into account any of the books. It doesn't take into account any of the spin-offs where people have come up with other ideas about what may or may not have happened, etc. It's solely based on what you saw and heard in the television show itself.
On the show
and it's
itself.
An incredible piece of work. And it takes in absolutely everything. So if the Doctor sort of said, oh, yes, the Mountain Mauler of Manhattan or Montana or whatever that Hartnell talked about in The Rescue, I think it was, or something. Yeah, he's like, so when was that? You know, when was he in Montana? How can we pin that down?
Thursday.
Thursday, exactly. But it's an absolutely extraordinary piece of work. And although the book itself, yes, it's a timeline, or the books themselves, there's two books. We wanted to do it as one book, but it came in at 1,400 pages.
Jesus Christ.
And the printers could only bind 800 pages in a single book. So we had to split it into two books so the printers could actually bind it.
Man, this sounds hardcore geeky.
It's hardcore geek. It's for your inner geek. I mean, the first volume is basically a book of essays which goes through every single element of conflict in the Doctor Who universe. So it talks about Dalek dating, Cyberman dating, Time Lord dating.
Oh, I dated a Dalek once. It was awful.
It was awful. unit dating. And it goes through everything you know and puts all of that into a conceptual whole. I think there's a chapter on how old is the Doctor, you know, so you exactly when has he said how old he is, you know, how does the Doctor's timeline differ from an Earth timeline in terms of years. Yeah, so the first volume is all these articles and information about supposition and how this goes together in terms of an overall whole. And then the second book is the timeline, and it also takes in Torchwood and Sarah Jane Adventures. Covers the whole lot as one organic whole based solely on what you saw and heard in those episodes themselves.
Wow.
And basically John has clearly indicated where he's made suppositions, where, you know, what he's saying is backed up by facts. There are obviously some things which you can't reconcile, so he's had to kind of come up with some way of, you know, understanding or explaining it. It's a lot of fun. I mean, it's not intended to be a definitive, because you can't be definitive.
Right.
But it's a lot of fun, and it certainly gives, you know, fans and the inner geek all that information as to how should this then work. And it actually given that Doctor Who is nigh on 50 years
right
of different stories written by different people at different times and made by different production teams without a single solitary thought as to what might have gone before, it is absolutely amazing actually how it all fits together more often than it doesn't.
It is a trilogy, because Hateful Heart, is it Hateful Heart? Is that right? Wait a minute.
Yep, that's right.
That's
Hateful
right.
Heart.
Now, that is not actually considered part of the trilogy, or tell me a little bit about that.
That's absolutely right, Lewis. The first three books are a trilogy.
Right.
And I just realized at the end of the trilogy that these characters were so interesting for me, and they had such a huge following that I wanted to write some more books about them. And so we've got, obviously, Killing Kiss, Futile Flame and Demon Dance are a trilogy,
right.
Although I think you can read Killing Kiss and Demon Dance without having read Futile Flame. You know, you can read them as standalone books. I think you need, if you read Futile Flame, you do need to read Demon Dance as well, because it ends on a cliffhanger.
Oh.
But Hateful Heart itself is very much a standalone book, and anyone who hasn't read the series could easily pick that up and really enjoy the characters and the adventure that they have. And it's kind of a thriller. that book. It's a fantasy thriller, and basically what we've got there is Da Vinci Code meets Raiders of the Lost Ark via Quantum Leap, if that makes sense.
With vampires.
Vampires are time traveling again, as they do in Demon Dance.
So was this one easier for you to write? Did it come just very easily once you got into it? Because I know I'm friends with you on Facebook, so I see your writing process, your updates and stuff when you
I write
go.
A lot. Yeah. A lot of depth. Yeah. Hateful Heart very much was an incredibly easy book to write. Uh-huh. And I think without prejudice at all, I feel it's the best one of the four at the moment. I really do. But I think every new book you write, you think it's your best one, because I've written another since then, and I think that's my best one. But it's a different series altogether, that.
Right.
Hateful Heart, I think, in the vampire series is without a doubt the best one ever, because it is a very complex, very detailed story, but not complex so that you can't understand it.
Right.
You know, it's still in my own unique style that, you know, is, I hope, a very digestible style of writing.
It is very accessible.
I know exactly what Dale's talking about there, because it's something that I talk to a lot of people, and you know, when I'm doing the Waterstones tours, I talk to people a lot about what they like about series, as particular vampire series. And one of the complaints is that they end up being very, very chunky books, but the story could be told in half of the size because it's filled with padding.
Right.
And it's Anne Rice is, you know, and I absolutely love her work actually, because I really like the historical content, but she does have a habit of filling it out with some, you know, fabulously written detail that is surrounding it's not necessarily relevant.
Exactly. I mean, vampires, zombies, that sort of stuff, they are so back in vogue, if you will. Yes. Literally, everybody seems to have a fascination with the paranormal and the undead again, which is great, and I love that. And, you know, the good thing about it is, I mean, without wishing to sound horrible, because I adore Twilight, because it requires no brain power to read it, frankly. as a light read, it's fun.
Well, I was just going to say, isn't that what reading's about?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like
you pick a book and you have a good time, you read it, whatever you engage with.
I mean, but there are different levels of it. I mean, it's like watching Doctor Who. You can actually watch Doctor Who on different levels. You can read a book on different levels. So I can't sit there and read Twilight or Eclipse or Breaking Dawn or whatever and sit there and thinking, oh, yes, I can understand Edward's emotional journey at this point because he's been through all this. And no, he's a vampire, she's a girl. They want to get in on and do stuff.
Yeah.
However, there are books like your books where you can actually really get into the characters. You know, you've taken time over their backstory. You know, it's not just this is Lucretia Borgia. She's a vampire. She's 150 years old. Let's move on to the next character, shall we? I'm like,
no, it's not like that, is it? No, I know.
So you can get into it on a much deeper level. I think the basis of any story is a really good character.
Right.
Sam's got them in spades. Sam's got tons of really, really good and rather sexy characters.
Oh, I love you, Dale.
Well, no, I think there's some of the protagonists in your vampire genre, you know, the vampires books. They're great. I love them. And you can actually sit there and think, ooh, that is a sexy moment.
Yeah.
And you know it, you can read it, and you just think, actually, yeah, I mean, there are I have an urge to be bitten by one of your characters, as you know.
I think that's my sexy Gabrielle, isn't it?
That would be your sexy Gabrielle, because I think he's gorgeous. Yeah, so literally, I can read that book and find him amazingly attractive.
Well, there's some...
But I can read Anne Rice and I read Anne Rice and I think Louis is absolutely gorgeous. It's you need to have a hook character that can appeal to one or other.
Yeah.
I think these days, I mean, being an ex-teacher myself, I think it's so hard to get teenagers reading in any way. Absolutely. And Harry Potter did, you know, J.K. Rowling did such a massive favour to teachers because boys are the worst to read. And this isn't a sexist view. This is absolutely statistically true. To get boys engaged with reading at all, you need to have a strong male protagonist.
Yes.
They won't read a book about a female protagonist. I don't enjoy it. Whereas girls will go along with the journey no matter who's the protagonist. And it isn't, you know, and I say this completely, it's not a sexist view. That is statistically, that's what they found in teaching. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of the information that we're taught. And so to actually give students a book like Harry Potter when it hit the shelves, which was so different and mm-hmm. so engaging and have this very strong character that boys could engage with, and of course it also had Hermione, which the girls could engage with.
Yeah,
and I think it had everything, and I think Twilight in a way has that too, because it's kind of, it's buying into a period of teenagers' lives where they feel a lot of angst and they feel a lot of insecurities, and they can relate so much. And I think this is the success of Twilight, is that it really does buy into that age group of puberty.
Yeah.
Just beyond that, all of us, I mean, I've totally forgotten about. But actually, you know, I mean, I'm an adult writer, so I don't write down there anyway in that sort of, I don't think in that way.
I mean, that is what I like about your writing. As opposed to Twilight, because Twilight I see as, well, yeah, although I love reading it myself, but then I still get massively stupid amounts of enjoyment out of reading a Dr. Seuss book. You know, Green Eggs and Ham is for young readers. Twilight is for early teen readers. Nice. I think the Vampire Gene Trilogy, etc., and Anne Rice are for when you've exhausted the Twilight Trilogy and think, okay, I need something a little meatier.
You need something challenging.
Exactly. So you up your game, and then you're onto things like your books, which I think are very cleverly written.
Well, hey, everybody. It looks like it's that time again to say goodbye. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Happiness Patrol. We always enjoy it when you tune in. We do it for you. We don't do it for us, obviously. We do it for you. So, well, we kind of do it for us anyway. So, but anyway, I would really like to take this opportunity to thank Miss Michelle H. and Mr. Andre T. for getting the amazing interview with Ian McNeese. Very nice. And also a special shout out to Barnaby Edwards of Who York. And also to the DoctorWhoShop.com to bringing Ian McNeese to New York and giving us the opportunity to have a little bit of time to interview him. So hope you guys enjoyed that. Also, big, big super duper thanks to Sam Stone and David J. Howell, friends of the Happiness Patrol, excellent people, just wonderful Doctor Who fans and amazing writers in their own right. Oh, well, I can't believe I just said that. So anyway. We got to go, but we will be back again next week. So until then, if you want a little bit more of the Happiness Patrol, you can always check out our blogspot. That's thehappinesspatrol.blogspot.com. Or you can also follow us on Twitter at The H Patrol. That's just The H Patrol. And we are on Facebook, so you can Google us and look us up on Facebook and join us there. And also, most importantly, we never really mention it all that much, but we're on iTunes. Most of you who are regular listeners probably download us from the RSS feed into your iTunes account or whatever you happen to be using. But yeah, go to iTunes and search the Happiness Patrol podcast and rate us. Tell us how good you think we are, that kind of thing, because it always helps. It always helps. So until next time, I am Lewis B. For Dale W., Leela S., and Nancy A., I am saying goodbye for now, and we will see you guys next week. So take care. See ya. Bye.
This is Leela S., and you've been listening to the Happiness Patrol.